Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at a health issue today, leukemia, and with our guest, Dr. Julie Chang. Dr. Chang is an assistant professor in hematology and oncology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, and is with us to answer the questions you might have. What do you have? What questions do you have about leukemia? Maybe you have someone in your family or a friend with leukemia. I hope you'll join in. 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Dr. Julie Chang, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Let's talk a bit about, well, let's first, what is leukemia?
So leukemia refers to some type of disorder or disease of the blood or bone marrow, and it's a generic term that encompasses a whole range of diseases, some of which can behave very aggressively. People can go from being entirely well to being ill and needing treatment within a few weeks to possibly just having some blood count abnormalities detected by your doctor that maybe won't need immediate treatment.
And how many, do we know how many people are afflicted with the various forms of leukemia?
So leukemia is a relatively rare type of cancer in the big scheme of things.
Yeah.
So about 3-4% of cancers diagnosed in the U.S. each year are leukemias. But the important thing to note is that even within that 3-4%, there are many different types. And so depending on the type of leukemia you have, you may have an even more rare type of disease.
And I expect if with a different, with the kind of wide differences, there may be also differences in symptoms of leukemia.
Definitely. The big distinction is between what are called acute leukemias and what are called chronic leukemias. So acute leukemias basically result from the bone marrow being filled by a very fast-growing cancer, and that's why it has the name acute. And so the bone marrow normally is responsible for producing the cells that make the immune system, for the cells that carry oxygen in your blood, for some of the factors in your blood that prevent bleeding. And so people frequently show up with things like fevers, being very weak because their oxygen-carrying cells are low. That's a condition called anemia. Sometimes they have bruising, and they oftentimes just don't feel well, like they've come down with a flu or some other type of acute illness. With the chronic leukemias, sometimes people don't have any symptoms at all. It might be something that was detected incidentally on blood work. Sometimes these patients may go in for a routine physical, and their physician may feel some enlarged lymph nodes on a routine exam. Sometimes patients could have symptoms like weight loss or change in energy level, but typically patients don't have a lot of symptoms when they have the chronic leukemias.
Okay. So is one worse than the other, one form?
That is a hard question to answer because there are so many different
yeah.
types. With the acute leukemias, that is a very serious diagnosis because although some patients can be cured with those types of diseases, it's a situation where if you're unable to get the disease under control into what we would call a remission, patients unfortunately are not able to live years and years with the diagnosis.
Okay. And when we think about treatments, types of treatments for that form, what are some of the types of treatments that one would have?
So for acute leukemias, the primary treatment would be combination chemotherapy. And typically that type of chemotherapy is given in the hospital setting because essentially what happens is you try to clean out the bone marrow as much as you can from the leukemia population, but you don't have a lot of good functioning bone marrow left behind. And so you kind of render somebody without a good functioning immune system and needing transfusions and a lot of other medical supports for a couple weeks until they're able to regrow some good healthy bone marrow and hopefully have the leukemia under better control.
Yeah. Talking with Dr. Julie Chang today, an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, as we visit with her and learn about leukemia. And again, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. I'm wondering about risk factors for leukemia. Are there things, is it genetic all the time, or are there, you know, is a smoker more likely to have, you know, what are the risk factors?
Sure. So we don't really know for most patients what the underlying event was that led to developing some type of leukemia. There are some risk factors that we do know about. So people who have had a lot of solvent exposure, so talking about things like benzenes, other type of carcinogenic exposures, we know that there is an increased risk of leukemia in those situations. People who have had significant amount of radiation exposure, for example, we see higher rates of leukemias. There's also an interest in whether or not certain types of chemical exposures in the environment, like pesticide exposures, may increase the risk. There is a higher rate of certain types of blood cancers here in the Midwest, and we don't necessarily know why that's the case, but our strong agricultural background is, and our potential chemical exposures through agriculture is thought to be a potential risk.
We have callers online who would like to visit with you. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. I don't remember if you mentioned genetics in this, but does it run in families?
Typically, having a case of leukemia run in a family or be an inherited predisposition, that would be extremely unlikely. There are some rare cases of that, but
Not the
norm.
Wouldn't be the first thing you'd worry about.
Right.
Okay. Jess in Appleton has something for us. Jess, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I have a question. My wife, Nancy, passed away on September 14th from AML leukemia. Her leukemia was directly a result of her breast cancer treatment 2.5 years earlier. How often do you see that?
Mm-hmm. So first of all, I'd just like to say I'm so sorry about the loss of your wife. It's difficult that she had to go through breast cancer treatment, but then leukemia treatment. That's even more tragic. One of the important risk factors for leukemia that I didn't mention earlier would be exposure to other types of chemotherapy. There are certain classes of chemotherapy drugs that we know can induce some long-term damage to the bone marrow. And probably about 5% of the time on average, people may develop some other type of secondary bone marrow disease or cancer, and that includes acute leukemia after being exposed to chemotherapy for treating some other type of cancer, including breast cancer.
Oh. Jess, do you have a follow-up?
I just wanted to put that out there because I had never heard of that before.
Yeah, and I too am so sorry for your loss. And I really appreciate you calling and bringing this to my attention and all the listeners' attention as well. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate the call very much. And I certainly will appreciate your call when you join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. I have one of the reasons, my reasoning for having this show is that I have a friend who has been diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And what can you tell us about that particular leukemia?
So chronic lymphocytic leukemia, as the name implies, is a chronic disease. So typically this is a disorder that kind of shows up very slowly and may not need immediate treatment. So the important thing to keep in mind about chronic leukemias is that we can treat them, but we can't cure them with any type of standard therapy. And so we typically think about managing these just as we manage a lot of other chronic diseases like heart disease or diabetes, where maybe we can't cure the disease, but we can manage it over time. So with some of these chronic leukemias, sometimes when patients first will see their physician and talk about how the disease will be managed over time, it's very frequent that we'll talk about an initial watch and wait or observation strategy. If people have the underlying disease and it's not causing any problems for them, sometimes the treatment that would be given would cause more harm than the underlying chronic lymphocytic leukemia or some other type of chronic leukemia. So it can be very challenging for patients when they find out that they have a type of leukemia, even if it is a chronic leukemia, to find out about this, try to process that information, and yet hear that, you know, they should do nothing about it potentially for months, if not years.
Yeah, I think the first inclination is to say, well, okay, what pill or what procedures can we do?
Right.
And so it can manifest itself. How does it manifest itself?
So with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, what happens is there's a certain immune fighting cell called a lymphocyte that basically acquires an anti-death gene. And so typically your cells in your body should know when to grow and divide and function. And when they're done doing all those things, they should die. And what happens is that these cells basically aren't doing their normal function. They're just kind of accumulating as trash within the immune system. And so they fill up the bone marrow. They fill up the glands in your body called lymph nodes, which is where these cells usually hang out until they're needed as part of the immune response. And what can happen over time is that as the bone marrow gets filled up with these abnormal cells, the normal healthy functions of the bone marrow can start to be diminished. And so people can start having low blood counts. They could become what's called anemic, which means that they're tired and their oxygen-carrying cells are low. People can also have enlarged lymph nodes that they begin noticing, most frequently in the neck, underarms, in the groin area. Mm-hmm. Another organ in the body called the spleen can start to enlarge, and when that happens, it can press on the stomach, and people notice that they get full really easily. They may start losing weight. And in some cases, patients can even describe things like fatigue, having sweats at nighttime, mm-hmm. A lot of other vague complaints.
And down the road, if, say, some years may pass, what are there then things that may be done?
There are many treatments for chronic lymphocytic leukemia specifically. Speaking with about that disease in particular, although this can certainly apply to many other types of low-grade leukemias. Once somebody starts having complications related to the chronic lymphocytic leukemia, they start having symptoms or their blood counts start to fall, that is a time when treatment can be initiated. And there are a whole range of treatments that can be given for this disease.
We have many callers online. The number to call again, 1-800-642-1234, as we visit today with Dr. Julie Chang of the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health about leukemia. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Dr. Julie Chang about leukemia, learning about that disease with her. And every one of our phone lines is filled, so let's take a call from there. Fanny in Hales Corners, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
It's a probably loaded question, but I have to ask it. At 80 years old, we have sent several people who have had a mammogram, and then they find out they have breast cancer, and they do take the treatments, and they are probably, radiation is even bad. And then I'm wondering, should people even bother to have mammograms? Because I think it's worse they end up in worse trouble then? Is there a cutoff date that people should stop looking for those tests? Because once if somebody finds it in their body, they don't want to, they want it out.
So yeah.
I don't know, but the treatment is sure devastating. Even radiation is. I've seen it too many times.
Well, I thank you so much for calling, Fanny. So here's she's asking, what about somebody in their 80s? So should they even be testing for cancers?
So I will answer that question to the best of my ability. At the University of Wisconsin, we tend to be very subspecialized in our cancer treatment, and I have to emphasize the fact that I don't treat breast cancer routinely and I'm not 100% up to date on some of those recommendations. But I do know that for patients who are lucky enough to have lived well and are in their 80s, you do want to start thinking twice about what it makes sense to do in terms of cancer screening. And that applies to things like mammograms and colonoscopies. And I'm not saying don't do those things, but it's important to talk with your physician about what are your other underlying health problems? What is your expected longevity? And what are the risks and benefits of doing those cancer screening? For leukemias in particular, there really aren't any screening tests that that are recommended to be done. It's not a very common malignancy. If it happens to you, your options for treatment are probably not going to be any different if you find out about it very early versus waiting until you develop symptoms or problems.
There we go. Fanny, so a little bit up in the air and probably depends a bit on the person. I thank you so much for that question. I want to give Holly in Alaska a chance to join in. Holly, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I have a question. If she has much information about essential thrombocythemia, if she could just make any suggestions about it.
Or comments about it. Well, okay, what is that leukemia all about?
Sure. So technically, essential thrombocytosis is something called a myeloproliferative disorder, which really involves the bone marrow and the blood. And so it really is a leukemia, although in the world of kind of classification and the medical literature, it is a little bit different type of disease. Basically, what happens with that disease is that some of the cells in the bone marrow just start making too many of themselves. And sometimes they make too many immune cells. Sometimes they make too many of the oxygen-carrying cells. In the case of this essential thrombocytosis, they make too many of these cells called platelets, which normally protect you from bleeding. But what can happen if you develop too many of them, people can be at increased risk for developing blood clots and things like strokes and heart attacks. And so that's why it's important if somebody's identified with that disorder to have appropriate therapy.
Hmm.
Do you know what the therapy is these days, or when the cutoff is as far as getting up to around 2 million platelet count?
It depends on several risk factors, and those risk factors have to do with age, whether or not people have other cardiac risk factors, prior blood clots. So for patients who have low-risk disease, sometimes we will let that number get over a million and sometimes higher. For patients who are older or they have several risk factors, we oftentimes try to have a goal of less than 600,000.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Holly, for calling. Appreciate it. And Joe in Fox Point, we are on to you. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Yes. Good morning, Larry and Dr. Chang. I am in my 60s. I am recovering from lymphoma. I've had, chemotherapy, then radiation, and then a bone marrow stem cell transplant. My two questions would be these. Could the doctor discuss the relationship between lymphoma and leukemia? And the second question has to do with the likelihood or possibility of recurrence. I'm doing very well, but I'm a little nervous about recurrence.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll hang up and take the info off the air.
All right. Thanks, Joe, for calling. Appreciate it. Leukemia and lymphoma.
So leukemia and lymphoma are close cousins of each other because they involve different cancers that arise from various cells in the immune system. Typically, we think of leukemias as presenting with bone marrow being involved by cancer or blood being involved by cancer, and lymphomas tend to involve more of the lymph nodes. So a typical patient with lymphoma would show up with enlarged lymph nodes. The things that can be very confusing for patients is that there are some types of diseases that have the name leukemia in them, but they're really formally lymphoma. So, for example, we were talking about chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and that's actually probably better classified as something called a non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And there's another type of disease called Burkitt's lymphoma, which we oftentimes refer to as Burkitt's leukemia. And it can be extremely confusing for patients and families and loved ones to try to understand exactly how somebody's particular diagnosis fits into the information they might be reading about the disease.
We have Elaine in Appleton next with a question. Hi, Elaine. Oh, wait a minute. There was a recurrence. He had a question about recurrence. Is there...
Sure. So the risk of having recurrence of a lymphoma, and this partly applies to acute leukemias too, that depends on a lot of different factors. It depends on the type of lymphoma or leukemia that somebody has. It depends on what kind of associated risk factors might have been identified in the cancer itself at diagnosis. We do know that for most of these fast-growing lymphomas or leukemias, the risk of relapse is highest in the first 2 to 3 years. And once patients are in a continuous remission for 5 years or more, that risk becomes significantly less.
Now we'll turn to Elaine in Appleton. Elaine, hi. Thanks for waiting.
I have a very strange question. I have a cat who gets vaccinations for leukemia, and there's 4 different types that cats can get, and they're all fatal. And I was wondering why a cat can get a vaccination, but a person can't.
That is a very interesting question that I never thought about. But as a non-veterinarian, I will do my best to answer this question. My understanding of the feline leukemias is I believe that those are triggered by some type of virus or some type of infectious agent. And in humans, it's not triggered by some type of infection. So unfortunately, the same mechanism for giving a vaccination to a cat to prevent leukemia would not translate to a human.
Understood. Okay. Interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Elaine. And Dan in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
Morning.
The question I have is I have CLL. I've been in remission for approximately a year and a half, and would like to keep it that way for as long as I can. Are there any studies that show any holistic ways I could treat my CLL to keep it in remission?
First, what is CLL, Dr. Chang?
So CLL is the acronym for chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And it's just a lot easier to say than chronic lymphocytic leukemia, but that's what we're talking about when we say CLL. I think the question that Dan asked is one that I get asked by most patients on most days that I am meeting with people about their disease, because people want to be as proactive as they possibly can to stay well and be well and prevent recurrences as much as they can. In terms of our understanding of what prevents a recurrence and what we can do to prevent recurrences, the knowledge about that and the science is actually pretty limited. And I try to be straightforward with patients about that if I knew about some particular herb or some type of meditation practice or exercise that would clearly prevent a recurrence, I would almost certainly share that with patients. But I think that even more important than that is focus on health and wellness so that when or if a recurrence does happen, that patients are well enough to receive the best therapy that's available. It's not uncommon where patients will develop a recurrence and then they just have multiple other health problems, be diabetes or, you know, just be very weak and inactive, where it's very difficult to even offer them the full range of therapies.
So if you take care of yourself and eat right and continue exercising and doing the normal things that a person would do to stay healthy, that's probably the best you can do.
That's really the best you can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There we go. Thanks, Dan. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. And that's a lot, actually.
It is a lot. That'll keep you busy.
Yes, it will. I was just realizing that as I said, oh, you sort of blew that off. And it's not always all that easy. I know my friend said, geez, it's hard to give up that glass of wine.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, maybe a glass of wine's okay, but not
Yeah, and I think there are some things that we just really devalue in the medical community in terms of their profound effects. So exercise, for example, has profound effects on the immune system, our stress response, our mood. And so focusing on the things that you can control and you can modify to optimize health, those are very important.
Leslie in Milwaukee, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Morning. I have a question about graft versus host disease. I have a friend who was diagnosed with ALL, and a bone marrow transplant was not an option. They couldn't find a match. And they kept her in remission for quite a while. She then came down with the other kind of leukemia, which comes from the chemotherapy, and she actually found a match. But she had a bone marrow transplant after that. Now she has graft versus host disease. And my question is there an end to this? What are the long-term expectations once you've had a bone marrow transplant and supposedly have, you know, tried to cure this disease? What are the expectations?
Sure. So, you know, this question refers to a specific type of therapy that is typically given for acute leukemias, but sometimes also for chronic leukemias. And a bone marrow transplant is a way of taking somebody else's immune system and using that immune system to fight leukemia or cancer cells. And we typically think about using that in situations where some of our standard chemotherapy or other drugs are no longer working. And the reason we reserve it for that setting is because even though it can be extremely effective, there also can be a lot of potential hazards with it too. And so what can happen is that the donor immune system, when it is setting up shop in the patient and trying to fight off leftover leukemia cells, it can also attack normal healthy tissues in the body. So that can include skin and gut and lungs, and people can have a variety of complications related to that we call graft versus host disease. And sometimes that can manifest as skin rashes, a cough, shortness of breath, changes in liver function, diarrhea, those types of symptoms. And the natural history or what happens over time with graft versus host disease can be extremely unpredictable. It's one of those complications that sometimes can be managed and it kind of burns itself out over time. There are other times where people can unfortunately be left with some chronic disabilities related to it.
There we go.
Okay.
Thank you, Leslie, for calling. And Hillary in Richland Center, on to you now. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I just had a comment. I was treated for acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and I was in the hospital for, you know, 7 days a week for 9 months. I was either receiving treatment or getting some type of blood product. And people always wanted to know, you know, what could they do for me? What could they do for me? And something that I would have to say would be to go out and donate blood, because I never realized how much blood went to people who are getting treated with cancer. In that time, you know, I had over 600 blood products. And I think that really makes a difference.
You're not going to disagree with that, are you, Dr. Chang?
I'm not. I'm really glad Hillary brought this up, because I do think that friends and family and loved ones really want to do everything they can to be supportive. And that is a very tangible, extremely important thing that friends and family can do to support somebody who has a leukemia.
Absolutely. Or in the many other conditions that require blood. I'm O positive. I like to give blood. Julie and Toma, it's your turn. Hi, Julie.
Yes, good morning. So my question, I have a young cousin who, has a lot of like those real vague symptoms, kind of gaunt and thin, dark circles under his eyes, fatigued. And they had done sent him, I believe, to UW to a pediatric, maybe hematology. They thought maybe he had leukemia because some of his blood work was off as well, whatever they look at. And it sounds like, the answer they got is, well, it's not leukemia, but they're not really sure why, why he has these symptoms and why he looks, some of his blood work is off. What are some things that could kind of mimic this? Or is this something that they should watch and maybe get second opinions on?
So this situation where people are kind of in a limbo where they're waiting to figure out what's going on, or where it's very challenging to figure out what a diagnosis is, that unfortunately happens not uncommonly to patients, and it's wonderful that you can be a good support. There are a number of things that can affect the bone marrow that can look like leukemias. So just because leukemia involves a cancer involving the bone marrow, that doesn't mean it's the only problem that can affect the bone marrow. So there are certain types of viruses that can affect the bone marrow and cause the bone marrow to not work very well. There are other types of autoimmune problems that can affect the bone marrow, that people can have a lot of symptoms where they just don't feel well, lose weight, have low blood counts. There are other conditions, something called aplastic anemia, where patients can just have the bone marrow not function very well and yet don't have a true cancer. And when people are in a situation where there's a very challenging diagnosis, it never hurts to get another opinion and another set of eyes to help figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a recommendation? Like, so if it's not leukemia, where would you send a family then to get more answers? Because, you're right. They're kind of in limbo. They know something's just not right with them, but they don't know what, and they don't know where their next step should be.
So there are a number of what we would call tertiary care centers here in the near the Wisconsin area. So those are basically large medical centers where they have multiple different specialties. So Mayo Clinic is close by, Medical College of Wisconsin, any number of the Chicago institutions.
So that might be it might be worth their while to visit one of those institutions. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Julie, for calling. Appreciate it. We have Beverly on Facebook asks if there's any progress against multiple myeloma.
So multiple myeloma is another type of blood and bone marrow disorder that is not technically classified as a leukemia, but it kind of runs in the same family, and a lot of the complications and approaches to treatment can be very similar as how we approach chronic leukemias. Myeloma is a disease where there have been tremendous advances in terms of new drug therapies in just the last 3 to 5 years. In fact, it's almost hard to keep up with all of the new drugs that are now available for treating multiple myeloma. And it is amazing how much treatment for that disease has improved in just the last 10 to 20 years.
That's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Rocky in Berlin, it's your turn. Hi, Rocky.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I was just wondering if years ago they used a lot of asbestos in building houses and stuff. Would that have any effect on leukemia?
So, Rocky, that is an interesting question, and I think that the known association between asbestos and leukemia is not particularly strong. There are some cancers where asbestos is very strongly linked. So, for example, a type of cancer called mesothelioma. But the association is much less strong for other types of cancers, including leukemias.
Okay. So less likely by for sure. Gordon and Eau Claire, thank you for calling.
Hi. In my extended family, we had a four-year-old diagnosed with a childhood cancer. And somewhere I picked up the notion that childhood cancers increase their risk for other kinds of cancers later in life.
Is that true, Dr. Chang?
So I will do my best to answer this, recognizing the fact that I'm not a pediatrician. And so some of the longer-term risks for pediatric cancers, I can't give as accurate an answer. But in general, the pediatric tumors are treated with chemotherapy with or without radiation, and any type of chemotherapy that's given to treat cancer can increase the risk of developing other types of cancers later in life, including leukemias. The good news is that with the pediatric tumors, most of our pediatric cancer specialists have a very kind of vigorous screening and long-term follow-up plan for their cancer survivors, so that for the cancers that they may be at risk for, depending on the type of treatment they have, they're having a very vigorous follow-up.
Interesting. We have Melissa had emailed on something relating to childhood leukemia. She survived it 25 years ago, just wondering about the changes or the new research that may have occurred over that time. She also mentions that she was exposed to Agent Orange when she was in utero and wonders if that could have caused her cancer.
It's always hard to know for a given patient what could have been a potential contributing factor. Given all of the potential adverse effects we know about Agent Orange, you would always wonder about that, and I would be suspicious if that was an increased risk.
Talking today with Dr. Julie Chang, assistant professor in hematology and oncology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, visiting with her about leukemia today and certainly inviting your questions and comments. I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network as we learn more about leukemia with our guest, Dr. Julie Chang from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And I'm always impressed with the kinds of questions that we get on this program, Dr. Chang. And I'm wondering, you know, when a patient comes to visit you or any doctor about this kind of problem or issue, or maybe it's for their loved ones, what questions should they be asking?
So the questions that somebody is going to ask may depend very much on whether or not they have an acute leukemia or a chronic leukemia, just because the urgency for treatment and how the disease behaves may be so different. So for example, for a chronic leukemia, we talked about the fact that these are diseases where we can certainly treat them. We can't cure them. And so it's very important to talk with your physician about where am I in the spectrum of this disease and when may I need to have treatment. It's also very helpful to understand what are the things that you and your doctor are going to be following over time to help make a decision about when things have changed enough to need therapy. The other thing that's helpful to talk with your physician about when you first get a diagnosis of a leukemia is, are there any good risk or bad risk features that are present with my leukemia at diagnosis, and how would that influence what we do to follow the leukemia or when I eventually need treatment?
And I'm also wondering, from, let's say I'm the one that doesn't have leukemia, how can I help my friend or my loved one cope with a leukemia diagnosis?
I would recommend the most helpful thing to do is to just listen. If you're not somebody who's in the medical community, and even if you are and you're not a cancer specialist, it can be very easy to confuse a person's diagnosis with maybe your basic understanding of leukemias in general.
Yeah.
And I think that it's very helpful to just talk with the individual affected about what are their concerns, how are they feeling, asking very open questions and just listening. I think that it can be very frustrating for patients when they get barraged with stories about, you know, their friend's aunt, or, you know, somebody who either did well or didn't do well with their leukemia treatment. How people are first diagnosed and what kind of therapy they need is probably going to be very different compared with maybe a friend or family member you've encountered before.
And I was thinking, too, there have got to be some good online, I mean, respected places that Mayo, you mentioned Mayo Clinic earlier. They have a guide to leukemia, if I'm not mistaken.
Another resource that I recommend very strongly to patients is the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Mm. They have a very easy website to remember. It's www.lls.org. And they have a very nice panel of information where patients can search by basic category and disease and different types of treatment. And there's a very nice overview for each disease about what we think causes the disease, how it behaves over time, basic treatments that are typically given, and potential complications.
And again, what's that site again so that we...
It's www.lls.org.
LLS.org. And Jill, our on-air producer, is wrote that down, and that'll be posted up on our Facebook page as well. So if you didn't get it down, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'll have it up.
And the other thing for listeners to know is that there are a lot of support groups and educational talks throughout the state that the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society puts on. And so going to that site, you can also search and find out what may be in your community.
Yeah,
that would
good.
Be helpful.
Excellent. Mark in Keel, Wisconsin, has a question. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thank you. My little brother came to me a little while ago and asked, I told him I might have to be tested as a possible donor. He was diagnosed with leukemia after several years of driving a tanker truck, and the doctor asked him right away, did you ever have to spend a lot of time around gas? And he did. But he was told now to hold off on the cure for as long as he can, because the cure often kills people. Evidently, what they would need my donor for, if I'm a match, as I get to replace all his, I don't know, bone marrow or blood, or what can I expect as a potential donor?
Sure. So this situation is a result of somebody needing a bone marrow transplant. And I had talked about that just a little bit earlier with another caller who brought up this issue of something called graft versus host disease. So in situations like this, perhaps your brother is not having a lot of other standard chemotherapy or other treatment options available to him. And so thinking about a bone marrow transplant may be the next best option for him. When you refer to the fact that this could be a very toxic therapy, you're right about that. You know, these are things like bone marrow transplants can certainly be effective in treating the leukemia, but there can be a lot of complications such as infection or this entity called graft versus host disease that can result. Now, the process for a person finding out if they're a potential donor to usually a sibling is pretty straightforward. Sometimes it involves a cheek swab or more commonly a blood draw. And then that sample is taken to the lab and they look at some of your genetic makeup to see if you're a close enough match to your brother. if somebody is found to be a match, that is information that is first shared with a donor. And so you can decide at that point whether or not you would want to disclose that to your brother and go ahead with being a donor. If somebody does become a donor for somebody undergoing a transplant, typically we are able to collect those stem cells that are needed for the transplant off of somebody's blood. So people often think they're going to need some surgery or some really invasive medical procedure to get those stem cells. But most of the time, we're actually able to collect that off of the blood.
Hmm, interesting.
So I could just make an appointment with his doctor then, it sounds like.
Correct. So typically what happens is that potential donors come in to see a physician. It frequently will be the same physician who may be treating your brother. And part of that is to make sure that a family member is healthy enough to be a donor.
Hmm.
Okay.
All right. There you go, Mark. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Aaron, who's listening online in France, actually emailed us and asked if you've heard of the ketogenic diet as a cancer therapy.
I have not particularly heard about that intervention. There have been a variety of different dietary or holistic interventions that have been of interest at various times, including eating an acid or a basic type diet.
We had another question about a raw food diet.
Yeah, and these are interesting questions. As of now, we don't have any firm evidence that that really alters the natural history of any of these types of cancers.
Brenda in Appleton has something for us. Hi, Brenda. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had something. I was really sick, and I went to a doctor, and I have low white blood cells. And then I got tested 6 months later, and I'm still very low on my white blood count. And I'm concerned because my mom had lymphoma. And so is there anything I can do to bring up my white blood count? I know there's things you can do to bring up your hemoglobin, but what about white blood cell count?
So the issue with your white blood cell count is probably something that you have very little control over. I think the most important thing is to keep working with your physician in terms of monitoring and perhaps having more diagnostic tests either now or at some point in the future. It's also very important to be very upfront with your physicians and medical providers about any herbal supplements or over-the-counter medicines or prescription medicines that you might be taking, because those could potentially impact the white blood cell count. Mm. But I don't think there's anything that you can do or not do or eat or not eat that's going to affect that low white blood cell count.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Ken in Green Bay has a question next. Hi, Ken.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if you could just touch base on, I had a prostate biopsy, and they found atypical cells. They're telling me, you know, it's not cancer, but it's something that they want to watch. It's very confusing. If you want to just touch on atypical cells, I appreciate that.
Sure. So what the type of atypia, or you know, how abnormal something looks, can vary significantly depending on what disease you're talking about. So normally in glands like the prostate or even the lymph nodes, we tend to see very regular patterns and very regular kind of organization of cells. So when we see cells that are breaking that normal, nice, cohesive pattern, or they're much bigger than normal, or instead of being nice and round and compact, they're very ragged at the edges and forming an abnormal pattern. Those are things that raise concern that a precancer or even a frank cancer could be present.
And if I'm not mistaken, the photo that we have up on our Facebook page shows, I believe, some abnormal cells, does it not? Or is that not, or am I incorrect on that?
No, you're correct. So on the Facebook page, it looks like there's a photo of chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And these are cells that are called smudge cells. That what happens, the chronic lymphocytic leukemia cells can be more fragile when they're spread out on a slide, and so they can look like somebody pressed them with their thumb and smashed them down.
So you could conceivably say that it's a possible cancer coming, or it's not, that's the gray area, I guess, that I'm seeing is... they can't call it cancer, but they can't say it's not going to happen.
Right. So there are types of cancers that we call in situ cancers, and that just means that, you know, something fishy looks like it's going on, and it could potentially evolve into a cancer. And so typically we think about treating those, or at least monitoring those types of situations.
And if you want to go to our Facebook page, just go to the title of our Facebook page is The Larry Mueller Show, and you'll see, if you want to take a look at what the abnormal cells might look like, there is a pretty good example, I think, right on our page in color. So I hope you'll do that, Ken, and anyone else for that matter. Thank you so much. Anna in La Crosse, you got a quick question for us before we take our news break.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. I'll be quick here. I personally believe that research, more research equals more cures. And I was wondering if your guest could quick comment on the fact that cannabis treatment for cancer patients, as far as people who are in severe pain or anything like that, since treatments cannot go through nationwide, because I actually don't understand why they can't.
All right, and I tell you what, we do need to take a break, but I'm going to let Dr. Chang ponder that question. Thank you so much, Anna, for calling. She'll ponder that question and certainly be ready to answer your questions, too. Join in, and we'll be right back with her after this look at the news. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking today about leukemia on the program, visiting with Dr. Julie Chang, who is an assistant professor in hematology and oncology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And just before the break, we had a caller with a question about, what was the question? I suddenly blanked on it.
It was about use of cannabis.
Oh, cannabis, yeah. That's right. And wondered your opinion on that.
Sure. So the use of cannabis in supporting patients going through cancer treatment is primarily for helping prevent nausea, vomiting, sometimes with helping stimulate appetite. So there is a prescription drug form that has the active ingredient in cannabis, and that drug is called dronabinol or Marinol. And we do prescribe that for patients sometimes, particularly when they are having problems with nausea and vomiting that's not responding to some of our usual treatments, or if they're having problems with poor appetite. Because cannabis is not legal, we obviously can't recommend that or prescribe that. We do try to caution patients that if they are going through cancer treatment, they really need to be careful about particularly smoking cannabis, because people can get exposed to all kinds of fungal and mold spores when they do that. That can put them at risk for unusual infections.
I'm going to go back to chronic lymphocytic leukemia for a minute. Jean on Facebook, and we call it CLL, wondered about the genetic component of CLL. Also, her father and his father had CLL. So is it more dominant in males?
So CLL is somewhat more common in men. It's not an overwhelming majority, but maybe 60-70% of cases of CLL will occur in men. We are getting a little bit better at understanding the genetics of different types of leukemias, particularly chronic lymphocytic leukemia. There are certain types of genetic mutations that we know can be associated with good response to treatment, kind of a slower growth pattern. There are also some very high-risk mutations that we can identify at the time of diagnosis that can help us counsel patients about the fact that this might be a more aggressive disease. They may need treatment sooner. They may have, they may need different treatments than patients who have a don't have some of these high-risk mutations. And so that gets back to what we talked about earlier, that talking about your physician about any adverse risk factors you might have present at diagnosis may really influence how you're treated and when you're treated.
And talking about treatments, what are the newer treatments out there for CLL and maybe for others as well, brother?
So CLL is an example of many different types of cancer where there's been extraordinary advances. So when I was first going through my medical training in this field in the early 2000s, CLL, there weren't a whole lot of therapies available. There was a drug called chlorambucil, which had been around since like the 60s, kind of an old sort of okay cancer drug, but it didn't work for very long or very well. And then a drug called fludarabine. And that was kind of it. Like once you burned through those two options, you really didn't have a lot of great treatment treatments available. And in the last few years, we have had over five different new chemotherapy drugs that have been approved for treatment of CLL. Some of those are standard chemotherapy drugs, so a drug called bendamustine. Some are what are called antibody-based therapies, a drug called obinutuzumab. It's also very interesting that there's several different oral targeted agents that have become approved for CLL. So these are agents that, in contrast to chemotherapy, which just kind of kills anything that's growing quickly in the body, not necessarily discriminating between cancer cells and healthy tissues. These are treatments that specifically target abnormal genetic pathways within the CLL cells. And so there's a drug called ibrutinib that was recently approved, a drug called idelalisib. These are oral targeted anti-cancer therapies that have very impressive activity in CLL. There's another drug called venetoclax, which has extremely impressive activity in CLL that will likely be approved by the FDA sometime in the next year. So it's very exciting, the changes that have happened in CLL. And I think 5-7 years ago, no one would have predicted how vastly the landscape of CLL therapy has changed.
That's wonderful news. Tom in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about follicular lymphoma. My wife has follicular lymphoma, diagnosed about a year and a half ago. She has small cell stage 2, but she doesn't really present any other way. She's opting at this point to hold off on treatment, and I'm just wondering what your opinion is on holding off on treatment as opposed to going in a little more aggressively right away. At this point, her physicians agree with her decision.
Sure. So Tom is specifically referring to a type of low-grade lymphoma, and these are blood and bone marrow diseases that act very much like the chronic leukemias, where you can definitely give good treatments that can knock the disease back and get a person into a remission where you can't really detect any active cancer. But we know that ultimately any treatment we give is not going to once and for all cure the lymphoma. And so in those situations, we really have to weigh what harm is the low-grade lymphoma doing and what are the potential harms of treatment. And for many patients who have a small amount of lymphoma, they're not having any symptoms, they're not having any complications, you could potentially expose people to side effects and longer-term risks from treatment, you know, perhaps many years prematurely before when the disease would change enough where it would become clear that they needed treatment. So particularly for, any patient, younger or older, observation is usually the preferred means of managing the disease in patients who are not having symptoms or complications.
There we go. Thank you, Tom. Sharon in Wauwatosa, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My brother was recently diagnosed with hairy cell leukemia, and we'd never heard of this before. And we were wondering what treatment therapies there would be for him, because we understand that this could be a chronic condition. He's 60 years old, and we're just wondering what the future might hold.
Mm-hmm. So hairy cell leukemia is a type of low-grade or chronic leukemia, and it gets its name from the fact that when you look at these cells underneath a microscope or you look at them in the bone marrow, they have these little projections or like antennae, or they almost look like hairs on them, and that's where that name comes from. Most of the time when patients have hairy cell leukemia, they show up with low blood counts and they might have symptoms related to that. This is a low-grade leukemia or lymphoma that has an excellent prognosis. So typically we think about giving a chemotherapy called cladribine, and patients can have very long remissions that last many years with this regimen. This is a disease that does tend to come back. We can typically use a variety of other agents when the disease relapses, including a drug called rituximab. So this is a type of blood or bone marrow disease that has a very good prognosis, and there are very effective treatment options available for it over the long term.
There we go.
Oh, that's great news. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Judy in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have another question about CLL. I've been diagnosed with that disease for about 15 years, and I've really never had any serious symptoms. I have normally a low white count, and the lymphocyte percentage has never really gone above 60%. And every once in a while, if I've been on antibiotics, it'll drop down into the normal area. So I'm just keeping my fingers crossed. I don't know how common it is for CLL to float around like that with not needing any treatment, or whether, you know, I can expect in the next 5-10 years that it's, if I make it that long, I'm not young anymore. But I just was wondering how common it is to go a very long time with CLL and not need treatment.
So thank you for bringing that up, Judy. That is a very interesting point. And there is a significant amount of variation in terms of how patients with low-grade or chronic leukemias or lymphomas behave over time. And it's not a one-size-fit-all pattern where the tumor doubles every 2 to 3 years, so when you're diagnosed, you can project exactly when you're going to need treatment. I certainly have patients in my practice, probably a dozen or so of them, that I have inherited from other doctors who have subsequently retired because they have just been doing well for so long and have never needed treatment, and their blood counts just are not changing. And we really don't understand what it is about an individual person's immune system or the genetic makeup of their CLL that makes them have their CLL stay so stable over the long term.
Well, that's really wonderful news. I will just continue to keep my fingers crossed. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Judy, for calling. I'm sure you've given other folks with CLL some positive thoughts as well there. Hannah in Ellison Bay wonders something. Let's go there. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, I'm calling because I'd like to know if there's a relationship between leukemia and polycythemia vera. My dad died of leukemia in 1974, and my sister has had polycythemia vera for a long time, and I wonder if there's a familial connection between the two, and also what their longevity might be from onset to demise in the polycythemia vera.
So when we hear about families such as yours, where there's been a parent and, you know, a sibling and maybe another family member who all have closely related blood diseases, it does make us question whether or not there could be some type of inherited tendency. I think the difficulty is that we haven't identified specific genes or heritable factors that could help us prove that. The other thing that we don't really know is, you know, could there be something that was shared in the environment by all family members that perhaps was the trigger and not necessarily the underlying genetics. The specific disease you asked about, called polycythemia vera, that's kind of a related bone marrow disease where patients make way too many of the oxygen carrying cells or red blood cells in the blood, and it can make the blood too thick, and people can be at high risk for developing blood clots. Longevity with that disorder is actually quite good, and in many cases it can be the same as somebody of the same age without the diagnosis, but there is a slightly increased risk of developing other more serious problems like bone marrow scarring or acute leukemias in a smaller population of patients with that disease.
Hmm. I have another little question. I have three children, and each of them have factor 11. Would that be a related thing, possibly?
So this factor 11 deficiency you're referring to has to do with a clotting system in the body, and that is almost certainly inherited given the pattern in your family. That is probably unrelated.
All right. Thank you very much for your help.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. Someone else wondered on Facebook, says her daughter is in recent remission from hairy cell leukemia. The daughter's husband is receiving a radioactive pill, in quotes, in a week or so. Doctors seem to disagree about the need for the wife to move out or just avoid him in the house. Any thoughts on this?
So typically when patients have some type of radioactive isotope therapy, so sometimes these are given, for example, for thyroid cancer would be a common example. My understanding is that usually we ask that those patients sleep in a separate bedroom for a period of days to maybe several days, depending on the actual dose that was given. I'm not sure that the individual or the wife who had prior hairy cell leukemia, I don't think that her risk is any higher or that she needs to do anything differently than what the doctors would recommend, just based on anybody having a family member living at home with exposure to a radioactive isotope.
Susan on Facebook says her daughter developed an infection after surgery when she was 14. She was on long-term intravenous antibiotics, developed bone marrow suppression. 8 years later, she still deals with immune problems and anemia. Should she be screened for leukemia as a precaution?
So thank you for this question. That sounds like a very difficult situation, and it's extremely unfortunate that happened to your daughter at such a young age. It sounds like what happened was that there was some type of injury to the bone marrow from the antibiotics, which just never fully recovered. We don't know if that type of situation really increases the risk of a person developing leukemia later in life. Now, even assuming that maybe it might a little bit, I don't think that there's any type of screening test that could be done that would change the treatment or prognosis if a leukemia happened. So your daughter probably is already having routine blood counts checked just because of this pre-existing problem. You know, that would be kind of the recommended screening test anyway if we thought somebody was at risk of developing a leukemia.
All right. Drew in Milwaukee has a question. Hi, Drew. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. I'd like to know from your guest, if there is a relationship between autoimmune disorders and leukemia.
Hmm.
So that's an interesting question. There are some autoimmune diseases that we know that there's a relationship with lymphomas. And remember, I was saying earlier that leukemias and lymphomas are kind of like very close cousins of each other. So, for example, there's a type of lymphoma called marginal zone lymphoma or MALT lymphoma, where we know that risk is significantly elevated in patients who have autoimmune diseases such as Sjogren's syndrome. We also know that patients who are on immune-modifying agents for treatment of things like rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune diseases are at increased risk for developing lymphomas in particular.
Is there a percentage or a risk? What is the risk of developing one of those?
It's hard to give you an actual percentage. I think some of the rheumatologic agents, meaning like these are drugs that are given to treat autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, there's probably a less than 5% risk of that happening. It might actually be quite a bit less than that. If somebody were to develop a lymphoma while receiving one of those drugs, typically one of the very first things we do is stop exposure to that drug, and typically we'll see some improvement in the lymphoma.
Interesting. Thank you, Drew, for calling. And Chris in Wanakee, it's your turn. Hi, Chris. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to relate. My parents were both born in 1924 in Milwaukee. They moved out to Menominee Falls when they were about 30, and we grew up there. When my dad was about 60, he contracted CLL, and he died at 69, probably from complications. My mom died at 85, but she was treated for CLL, much less serious case. And then when I turned about 60, I was diagnosed with MDS, myelodysplastic syndrome. But now my hematologist believes that basically I just kind of have chronically or habitually or safely low counts of my blood cells. And I just, so these are not, I'm the only one who's related to the people who had CLL, but I don't have any symptoms. And my parents obviously weren't related by blood. Yeah. And I thought that was kind of another interesting way to wonder about the environmental factors that might be involved.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, we hear stories like that, and it makes us want to do some type of, in-depth analysis in terms of what in the environment could have triggered this so we can better understand factors that can contribute to the disease. But, you know, the truth is there are so many things in the environment that it's very difficult, you know, if not impossible for a given family to kind of figure out exactly what was in the environment that could have predisposed to this particular type of disease.
And it could have been something that was in the environment long ago and is not in the environment now. So checking and being able to verify would be really, really very difficult. Well, Chris, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And CLL, genetically, is there a genetic component? I think we said no, or probably not.
Probably not. There may be some cases where it seems to be in multiple family members, and there probably is an underlying genetic link, but that would be the vast minority of cases.
Well, this has been a most interesting show, and I think you've helped a lot of people today, Dr. Chang. I'm wondering if you'd be willing to come back and be with us again.
Oh, certainly. Thank you for having me.
It was wonderful to have you here, and we'll get you back maybe in six, 12 months down the road and see what's happens.
Great.
Since your last visit. Dr. Julie Chang does a wonderful job, doesn't she? Man, she answered lots of questions today, and I really appreciate having her with us. She's an assistant professor in hematology and oncology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, treats a wide range of cancers, but has a special interest in lymphoma and complications of cancer involving the central nervous system. And we will have her back, and we'll talk with her again on this program for sure. Just a quick look for tomorrow. We'll learn about tips meant to help our... we'll be getting some tips to help our lakes and streams at 11. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.